Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. No, I did not blast off into space with Jeff Bezos, but it is nice to know that space is now safe for billionaires. Look, I'm not going to give you one of those hipster takes on all of this because I do think the technology is cool. I think the research is going to have all sorts of spinoffs. It is remarkable watching all of the news coverage. I don't know what it is about billionaires going into space that makes the media just absolutely giddy. And again, I'm not trying to be negative about it because it is exciting, but it does seem like just sort of a weird moment in our history. Meanwhile, the January 6th investigation continues. We have the appointees Kevin McCarthy, the Republican appointees to the committee, which are pretty much exactly what you'd expect. We will talk about that. In fact, we're going to be joined by Ryan Riley, who is the senior justice reporter for the Huffington Post, who's been covering all of this, including the sedition hunters and the way the litigation is playing out. So might as well just say, hey, good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into all of this, could you just talk about the weird thing that's going on at Fox News right now? Now, I don't know whether all of this is connected or whether it's not where it comes down, but it's certainly interesting. Fox News has been under tremendous pressure and criticism, which they've so far completely blown off and ignored, to do something about all of the vaccination disinformation coming out from their hosts like Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson. And the growing chorus of people saying, you know, that people are dying as a result of this misinformation. And three things happened yesterday. We find out that the Fox News has very quietly implemented its own vaccine passport system for its own employees, which is kind of interesting, considering that many of its primetime hosts are regarding those as fascists. That's number one. Number two, you had some of the morning hosts, Steve Doocy, who went off telling people to get their vaccinations. And then rather remarkably, you had this moment from Sean Hannity last night.
Just like we've been saying, please take COVID seriously. I can't say it enough. Enough people have died. We don't need any more deaths. Research like crazy. Talk to your doctor, your doctors, medical professionals you trust based on your unique medical history, your current medical condition, and you and your doctor make a very important decision for your own safety. Take it seriously. You also have a right to medical privacy. Doctor-patient confidentiality is also important. And it absolutely makes sense for many Americans to get vaccinated. I believe in science. I believe in the science of vaccination.
Okay, so Ryan, I don't have any first-hand information on that. Maybe I'm too cynical here, but that felt like he was reading something someone gave him. You know what I'm
it
saying?
It does. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because you could have turned this entire thing around and made it sort of a celebration of how well Trump did, right? And like, take your Trump vaccine or like gone along those lines or something of that nature. But, you know, unfortunately, what's happened is that, you know, Dr. Fauci has sort of been demonized and he's become this sort of political target on the right. And I just think that, you know, it is remarkable because you obviously see that the people, you know, in the suites up there at Fox News are taking this very seriously. And, you know, the Trump family obviously has their vaccines, but, you know, they have to also appeal to this constituency that's very suspicious of this vaccine and how we're going to get back to normal.
Yeah, but the messages are certainly mixed. So right before the clip I just played, Hannity was ripping this university for mandating the vaccines. And then immediately afterwards, he interviews this young woman who says that she lost feelings in her legs after taking some different kind of vaccine. So he's still kind of bookending it. And then, of course, Tucker Carlson comes on and he tells the viewers they should ignore people giving you medical advice on television. So who the hell knows what's actually going on Fox News?
It's really bizarre. I mean, yeah, I just can't imagine like the messages that if you're a normal Fox Newser, you know, has been absorbing. It must be really confusing to sort of, you know, hear these two different sides of the coin there. You know, but there have been people I saw someone was writing about someone on Twitter who said, you know, oh, my husband is, you know, a huge Fox News guy and won't believe me about the vaccine. But when, you know, Steve Doocy got up there and said, yeah, take your vaccine, he took that more seriously. So well, I guess if it has a positive impact, it just seems a little bit late. It seems like, you know, now is a few months too late and when we really needed this more serious push.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's good. It may literally save lives, but it does feel a little bit late. And you kind of wonder whether it's going to be whether it's going to be consistent or whether it's going to be just one of those little spasms that they, you know, right before they go back to the norm. Okay, so let's talk about January 6th and everything that's going on here. There are a lot of developments, including Kevin McCarthy has named five Republicans to the select committee to investigate January 6th, including Jim Jordan. Well, out of the five, three of the five are believers in the big lie. So, I mean, I think you got a signal here exactly how seriously Kevin McCarthy is taking that investigation. Will it have any effect, you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is definitely going to be, they're definitely going to be bulldogs there who are sort of fighting this every step of the way. And the fact that you have three people on there who actually, even after that attack, voted, you know, against democracy, essentially, is really, I think, remarkable and is not a great sign for any hopes of bipartisanship, I think, on this commission going forward. It depends upon the questions they explore here. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of efforts, obviously, and we even saw this in the sentencing yesterday, to sort of, you know, whataboutism this? Like, you know, okay, what about, you know, what about Portland? What about, you know, all these riots that we saw over the summer of 2020? I think that that's going to be a constant theme here, and saying, oh, you're throwing the book at these sort of Trump insurrectionists. And, you know, I think I'm very attuned to things can go either way, right? So if there's overreach against one political party, that can just, you know, in a few years go the other way, and protesters from the other side of the political spectrum can be really hit really well. But it seems like, you know, either people weren't paying attention or people weren't necessarily caring about some of, I think, the overreach we saw during the Trump administration against sort of more left-wing protesters in a lot of cases. And it's sort of been memory hold now. And, because there is so much chaos, I think, in the Justice Department during the Trump administration in general, during his 4 years in office, that this wasn't covered as well. But one thing I covered really closely was the J20 protests, which were the protesters who the streets on Trump's inauguration. And there was the feds really took a remarkable approach to that. Now in DC, because we don't have a local elected prosecutor, the feds, the Justice Department, prosecute both local and federal crimes. So a lot of crimes are, you know, through the U.S. District or the U.S. District Court. Some of the crimes are through D.C. Superior Court. And what happened during the J20 protest and the Trump inauguration is a lot of people were kettled on the street and arrested and had these severe felony charges against every one of them. And the government's argument was that everyone was part of this conspiracy, so that, you know, when we saw those images of a burning limousine or smash storefronts, that anyone who was there at that time was also responsible for what happened. And the government failed at that pretty miserably, because the first six people they put up to trial, they tracked them all the way through the protest, and they admitted that they found zero evidence of them actually smashing any windows or burning or looting anything. And they were, I mean, these were felonies that could have sent them away theoretically at maximum sentence for decades, right? It was sitting in court watching that, and then now hearing, oh, there's this big overreach against the Trump supporters on January 6th. It's this just break for me. It's like, no, I sat through this. I sat through some of these really extreme charges. You know, popping someone for a misdemeanor offense that's the equivalent of what you would get if you held up a cardboard sign during an ongoing committee hearing, you know, for actions taken on January 6th isn't this extreme overreach. Yes, it's getting more attention, I would say, certainly from the media. All of these cases are being covered individually, so that's sort of a separate component. But like, that's not an extreme overreach here. And I've been very attuned to, you know, overreaches from the government here, and I haven't really seen these broad overreaches yet. Maybe there are a couple of cases where they could have, you know, let someone out, or the government argued for incarcerating someone before trial, but other than a couple of mistakes that the FBI has made, there hasn't been this overreach, I think, that people are describing.
So let's talk about, I know you've been covering how the FBI has been investigating this, the sedition hunters. The New York Times is out with a story, how Trump's focus on Antifa distracted attention from the far right threat, that reporting how federal law enforcement shifted resources last year in response to Trump's insistence that radical left endangered the country. Meanwhile, right-wing extremism was building ominously. This is something that you've covered. And it is an interesting story because, of course, when the president of the United States says this should be a law enforcement priority, it's not this. It's not the right wing. It is Antifa. This had a real effect in the real world. So talk to me about what your reporting has found out about that.
Yeah. So let me take you back. Like, sort of, this is right after George Floyd's death, and we're in Jackson, Tennessee. There's, you know, a couple of peaceful protests, but nothing really big going on. And what happens one day is this guy, Justin Kaufman, goes on Facebook, and, you know, he's obviously upset about George Floyd's death. He's a supporter of Black Lives Matter. He for his band, which is called the Gunpowder Plot, you know, sort of the historical references, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will pick up on, but he posted these clearly staged images of him posing with a fake Molotov cocktail behind his back. So there's three separate photos. You know, you see the aperture in them. You see the artistic design. It's very clearly staged photos, and they were obviously photos for a photo shoot. And afterwards, you know, everyone is sort of on edge. Police are on edge, and this becomes a big thing in the Jackson Police Department. Justin hears about it. He actually proactively reaches out to the Jackson Police Department and says, "Hey, listen, these aren't real." Devices.
Justin, this is Justin Kaufman.
Correct. Right? He reaches out to the
punk rocker. Yeah.
And he reaches out and says, proactively, like, reaches out to them and says, "Hey, just, you know, wanted to make sure we're all straight here," gives that information to the police department. Nevertheless, days later, his home is raided because they were saying that it was a hoax device under Tennessee law, even though there's a specific exception in that law for dramatic performances. And they found in his home was a gun that he was legally allowed to own, but they also found a small baggie of marijuana. And there's this federal statute that is rarely used, that is more commonly used against users of other drugs, but occasionally has been deployed against users of marijuana, that they used in this case and actually came up with a federal charge against him for. But that wasn't until months later. So this raid happens in June. So that's June, July, August, September, October, right when, you know, a few weeks before the election, right as Bill Barr is on this really big, you know, kick and about Antifa, and so is Donald Trump, and that's sort of their focus. That's when they decided to pop this case out. And then,
this was kind of their poster child, right? I mean, this punk rocker, this was like, okay, we got somebody, we're on the case, we're doing something about this.
Yeah, and they like really, and I mean, first, you know, there's nothing going on in Jackson, I think, is a really important component of this. So it was sort of almost like they were like desperate to go up to the big leagues, I think, some of the local cops there, right? It was like, oh yeah, we want to be a part of this, right? Obviously, they didn't like his political views. And that just sort of comes across. And they really hid the ball here, because in the search warrant affidavit, in the press release materials on this, in the charging paperwork, there's mention of this Facebook page for the Gunpowder Plot, but there's no acknowledgement at all that it's a band, right? Like, they just leave that completely out, and that this was a photo shoot. So basically, now down the line, what this judge is saying is that, you know, they really hit the ball here, and like, clearly this was a photo shoot, clearly this was a band, and you left all that information out, you hid that, and that this search warrant was bogus and shouldn't have been executed in the first place, because the explanation that Justin Kaufman gave to police before his home was raided was very credible, that these were posed images for a band, which you could have surmised simply from looking at those images on Facebook. It was just very clear that these were posed images,
and the judge has agreed. I mean, this is a Bush era judge, and he has just totally slammed this. So you've been also covering the various cases that have been moving through the courts, and the one that is getting the most attention, obviously, today, is the case of Paul Hodgkins, one of the Trump fanatics, who was the first felony Capitol riot case that we've seen, and he got just 8 months. Or tell me whether or not it is just 8 months. Your take on that, because there were a lot of commentators who were surprised that it was that small a sentence for a felony, and whether that sends a message to other protesters.
Yeah, you know, I don't think we should ever think of 8 months as not being a significant amount of time. Any time in prison is significant. But it was certainly much lower than what the federal government had requested in this case, which was 18 months. And it was even lower than the sentencing guideline range in his case, which would have also been a few months longer. But I think that the judge was very clear that this case was sort of set apart from other cases. You know, the judge was very interested in how many people actually entered into that Senate chamber and how many people were we talking about here. And I think what this defendant got credit for was the fact that he was one of the sort of the first over the gate and was very ready to sort of plead guilty to a felony in this case and you know, move past this, take accountability for his actions. And of course, the fact that he didn't actually commit any violence. So he had some, you know, he came there with goggles. The prosecutors talk about all of these decision points where he went the wrong way, you know, when he left the Trump rally early and started marching to the Capitol, when he passed those barricades, when he went into the Capitol, and then when he went into the Senate, which the entrance into the Senate chamber is what escalated this from a misdemeanor to a felony. And I think that that's what the context of this really was, is that the judge was looking at this and saying, you know, he was looking at individualized justice for this defendant, which I think is what, you know, it's not so, I think that a better way to think of this is what you want for every defendant across America is sure, individualized justice. So I think, you know, on the left, certainly we've seen a lot of, I think, outrage about the length of the sentence here, but this isn't it is a felony case, but is not one of the more severe felony cases. Now, I would be shocked if we saw some of the more violent cases where we have these, you know, officers being dragged down the stairs and tased. If we saw that, I just don't think is even remotely plausible that we'll see that sort of offering in that case. Well, I think because of this was essentially just he entered into he was part of this, but he was not a really hardcore participant in it.
So what is the status of the conspiracy cases? I mean, we do know that some of the Oath Keepers are cooperating with the government. What should we be watching there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are going to be more conspiracy cases to come, frankly. There's a lot of these sort of cells in different areas, as you would call them, that grouped together and came together and had a plan. Of course, the big ones on the table right now that will, I think, probably continue to expand in some cases are the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. And, you know, I think there's going to be some cooperation there. But there's only so much benefit that can have for a lot of defendants because in a lot of cases, they've got everything they need from the communications they've gotten off their cell phones. Even if they are using encrypted apps and they've been able to access those phones, they have sort of a trove of information on that, unless there was deleting messages, which they did in some cases. But there's only going to be so much benefit I think some of these defendants could take. But a lot of them, you know, their legal strategy is pretty laid out. It's more of a public relations sort of strategy and a money raising strategy, because some of these, a couple of the defense attorneys that have gotten involved here, you know, are sort of known for fundraising and because they're sort of right wing figures and are raising money off of this and are making this a political issue and, you know, claiming that their defendants prisoners.
That's what I wanted to ask you about is how the sort of the shift in the politics of this has affected the cases. You have Donald Trump now describing some of the demonstrators / rioters as patriots and beautiful people. Clearly, there is an effort to turn them into martyrs, heroic martyrs. Is that changing their posture? Are they? I think you've already answered this, but I mean, is it across the board making them less willing to negotiate with the government? More confident in their defenses?
Yeah, you know, I think on both sides, there's kind of like this idea of everything's black and white when a lot of things are in gray. So on the right, you have this idea of, all the images that they know about are in some circles, I think, of the internet are the only ones, things that they've seen are people who are walking in between those, you know, barriers and peacefully, I guess, marching through the Capitol. And that's the footage that they focus on. And then, you know, on the left, it's all that brutal, you know, medieval battle right outside. And the truth is, a lot of these cases, I do think that there were people who were there who didn't realize what was going on in other parts of the building. And I mean, you know, not a lot of these people were necessarily, you know, really well educated about the operations of the federal government. You had, for instance, a defendant who thought he was at the White House and said three times, "I'm at the White House. We're storming the White House," when he, you know, had his hand on the Capitol. So there's not, you know, I think, you know, ignorance is certainly a component of this for sure. But, you know, I don't think that, as we move on from here, there's going to be these very political arguments that are being made about the accountability. And, you know, I think that that's the fundraising is going to be a major component here. And some people are very successful at saying, listen, I'm being victimized by the Biden administration here, and I'm a political prisoner, even though there's video of them, you know, assaulting an officer and some something of that nature. That's what they're, that's the case they're making right now, is that they are political prisoners.
Hey, let's take a quick break here, and we'll be back with more from Ryan Riley, and particularly his work on the sedition hunters. These are the online sleuths who are aiding the FBI's Capital manhunt. Hey, Charlie Sykes here. Just a quick reminder, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you will have access to our morning newsletters, to JVL's Triad, as well as our whole suite of podcasts. This one will remain free, but if you want to listen to the Secret Podcast or participate in our live streams or others like the Next Level Podcast, please consider joining Bulwark Plus. We're back with Ryan Riley from the Huffington Post. Ryan, right before the break, I just promoed this, all the work you've done on the sedition hunters. One of the most fascinating parts about this whole investigation is the way that the FBI has used social media on online sites to track down the hundreds of people who stormed the Capitol. So talk to me about who these people are and how it works.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of these people, it's sort of an impromptu pop-up organization that came together that's really loosely affiliated and works sort of in different groups, but is tracking people by hashtag.
But it's not law enforcement itself. These are private citizens doing this?
Average Americans. You know, I've talked to a lot of mothers and fathers who are sort of doing this around their homeschooling schedules. One of my favorites is this woman from around Hershey, Pennsylvania, who I've spoke with for a while. And she was FBI witness number two on one of these early cases. The name Brent Bozell the Fourth might ring a bell with you.
We recognize so he's, that name.
Very well. His family has been a major part of Republican politics for decades, for, you know, last half century or more. And he was an individual who was spotted on the floor of the Senate. And the way that they came about wasn't because someone, you know, in politics or recognized him and saw a photo of him. This came about because of this local mom who was contacted by someone off of Sedition Hunters, and actually then sort of went down a rabbit hole on Facebook and went to, he was, Brent Bozell the Fourth was wearing a sweatshirt for his children's school, which was pretty specific. Mm-hmm. It's a small Christian school. And all this woman did was went down Facebook and was looking at everyone who had ever liked any image that was posted on the Facebook page for this school, and eventually found Zeker Bozell, and then figured out that Zeker Bozell was Brent Bozell the Fourth, and found another image of him. Even though he tried to like sort of cover up his Facebook profile a bit, she was able to sleuth it out. And has now has this, you know, ongoing relationship with the FBI, where she continues to figure out all of these connections between different people in Pennsylvania who traveled to the Capitol on January 6th, and continues to send them information. And of course, Brent Bozell is now facing a felony charge because she not only found there was not only video of him actually in the well of the Senate where he had no reason to be, but he actually smashes out a window. And because of that work, that of connecting all of these different pieces of information and YouTube videos and Instagram videos and Facebook videos and Facebook images, there's just been a tremendous amount of work by open source investigators, as they like
to
describe.
So who are these people? They're open source, but who are these people? I mean, are these people who have backgrounds in investigation, or are they complete amateurs who are pretty good with social media and doing this sort of thing?
It's a mix. You know, I've used the phrase like Motley Crue to describe them before, and like some people have taken like offense to that, but I mean it in like the most complimentary way. It's a very, I would say, sort of diverse geographically, age-wise group of people, and you just have people from all walks of life who are working on this. There are people who are really good coders and are organizing websites that allow you to like look at individualized information and say, okay, I'm looking at this time. I want to find this. I want to look at this particular location around the Capitol at this time and view all the videos, and then organizing those hashtags. So anytime that you spot a suspect in a video, and maybe you can escalate their charge from, you know, oh, they were only a misdemeanor offense, to a felony because you see an assault on a cop, and organizing all that information, hashtags. And, you know, the FBI, I mean, is a little bit flat-footed here, frankly.
See, this is what's amazing to me, because, you know, in my mind, I'm imagining, you know, all these FBI agents with all the computers and everything and the satellites and the NSA listening into everybody. And in fact, it's not them. It's these homeschooling moms who are this motley crew that's doing it on their own.
At the beginning of the, I mean, you've got to think this is a really unique investigation for the FBI. This is like nothing they've ever done before, right? But when they wanted to go after a bank robber locally, what they would do is they would give that bank robber a nickname, show some images of him, and put out a PDF with his photos on it. So essentially, you know, after January 6th, you saw the FBI have the same reaction that they've had in these previous cases. They treated it sort of as a, you know, a local robber and posted these PDF images, which in the internet age in the 21st century just weren't extremely helpful. So now the FBI has their approach has evolved a little bit, and they're putting out individual photos of some of these defendants, but it's still not quite as good as what amateur sleuths are sort of putting together on their own in this sort of disorganized manner. And, you know, the FBI is still sort of a little bit behind. They have a lot of capabilities beyond what a lot of these sleuths do. But there's a lot of frustration, I think, in these sleuthing communities that are like, okay, if I had access to, you know, this trove of cell phone data, and I basically, you know, they've compiled enough information where there's a case. All they need to do is get that confirmation that cell phone was, you know, around the Capitol that day, and boom, they're done. The facial recognition has been the really creepy part of this to me, where some of these amateur sleuths have been able to figure out who people are based on facial recognition software that they get on the internet. So they'll be able to track someone throughout the crowd based on facial recognition, and then also just find out who that person really is. And that's been a really successful way that they've gone about doing these information, then confirming that that identification through additional information and presenting it to the FBI.
Well, talk to me about how law enforcement cooperates with these folks, what the interface is, because, you know, clearly, you know, some of these people have valuable information for the FBI, for law enforcement officials, but they are not themselves law enforcement. So therefore, they can't have access to certain information that law enforcement might get with a warrant. So how does that actually work? I mean, is there any tension within the FBI about cooperating with moms from Akron on this? Or are they like, hey, this is fantastic, it's wonderful, let's deputize her?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's varied. I think that now there, at this point, there's some of the really hardcore sleuths have individual relationships with FBI people they can speak with directly. But the feedback loop is frankly a problem on this, because what happened is right after January 6th, we saw all these tips, literally hundreds of thousands of tips, flood into the FBI. Yeah. And the FBI is still playing catch up on a lot of those tips. And there's not this feedback loop. So there was one sleuth I was talking to who was sort of jokingly suggesting that she would have liked the FBI to take more of an approach that Domino's does. Like, you know, you love the Domino's pizza tracker. It's like, okay, your order's in, it's in the oven, here's what's happening with it. And instead with the FBI, it's like you dump off an email and you never hear from them again until maybe one day the case pops. And it's sort of tough for them to get, you know, to know what's happening on the other side of that screen, or if anyone is even individually assigned to their case, because there were plenty of cases that were overlooked in the early days and the FBI is only now catching up to. So, you know, there are obviously very reasonable restrictions on what the FBI I can say about ongoing cases and how they can keep people sort of informed there. So it is that tension that's sort of ongoing here. But, you know, now I've heard that a lot of sleuths have been talking, who have individual relationships with FBI agents, have been talking to them and getting more context from the FBI about just what's going on behind the scenes, because truly it is an overwhelming investigation. And there's a lot of different components to this. Some of the delays are technical. Some of the delays are, you know, maybe more to do with the field office and how overwhelmed they are, their individual assignments in that area. Perhaps some resistance to bringing some low-level charges from some of the people. I mean, you know, it's funny to talk about now, but the FBI is a generally, I would say they're probably like Romney Republicans. They're generally conservative-leaning organization, even though it's sort of been demonized as this liberal cabal now. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of different components that are going into why some of these delays are happening. And now sleuths are sort of getting a little better handle of that, even if there's this continued frustration from them about what exactly is going on with these cases that they sort of feel like they handed to the FBI on a silver platter.
So going forward, though, this strikes me as a very interesting development, because if, in fact, we do have the problems of domestic terrorism and domestic extremism, one of the big questions has always been whether or not the FBI has the manpower and the resources to be able to monitor all of this. And listening to you and reading the stuff you've written about this, it occurs to me that what you're seeing develop is sort of organically a network that's going to be around, that will continue. Well, tell me if I'm right about this, that will continue to monitor these after we're done with January 6th, that in an ongoing basis, this does expand the footprint of people with eyes on many of these extremist organizations and activists.
Yeah, I think that's true. A lot of people who got into this in the early days are going to continue to follow these local organizations and groups going forward, but that's not a long-term game plan necessarily for the FBI here. And, you know, historically, obviously, if you go back 100 years into the FBI's history and you look at some of the awful things that the FBI did mm-hmm. over the years against, people who they disagreed with politically, who are not in favor with the state. There's obviously a lot of protections and sort of walls in place now about respecting First Amendment rights and ending investigations when there's no reason for them to continue, right? There's sort of a ticking right. time clock as soon as an investigation starts about, okay, do we still have the reason to continue with this investigation, or do we need to shut it down? So, you know, domestic terrorism has been something that the Bureau has been struggling with for a very long time. And I think that the Biden administration has now proposed adding a lot of money to figure out how exactly to keep track of a lot of these organizations. But it's going to come up with some really complicated questions, because if you go back, you know, to the early Obama era, and we remember when there was that DHS report mm-hmm. that was sort of talking about the threat of right-wing extremism and the political reaction that we saw to that at the time. So there are these very high sensitivities, and I think that will continue, especially as we continue to see the FBI churning out these cases against all of these Trump supporters. There's going to be this continued political grind. And I think that's the same thing with the January 6th Select Committee, that it's going to be highly politicized, and the FBI is going to be very, very cautious and have to be careful about how they're,
well, that's
how they're
right.
approaching this.
And I'm glad you raised it, because I mean, obviously there's an upside into finding the rioters of January 6th, but there is a danger of having a large number of, shall we say, vigilante online private sleuths out there spying on one another. I mean, that's something that you clearly need to find a quick balance. Now, in your beat for the Huffington Post, you cover the Justice Department in general. I'm interested in your take on Merrick Garland and the approach that he's taking to prosecuting or not prosecuting former officials of the Trump administration, including most recently the decision not to charge anybody in the case of lying about the census, including Wilbur Ross. So give me your take about Merrick Garland and the approach that he's trying to take, which is clearly very disappointing to many progressives. Who I see online are just hammering him today on this Wilbur Ross case.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's sort of what we expected. I think that this was the approach that he sort of took. He wasn't this sort of, you know, dyed-in-the-wool liberal who was going to come in and overhaul everything necessarily. He takes outside expertise, and he brought in, I think, two people into first of all, the head of the Civil Rights Division and the number three position at the Justice Department, who are more, you know, progressive, and I think there's certainly interesting debates, I'm sure, unfolding behind closed doors about how the Justice Department approaches some of these issues on criminal justice reform in particular, and some of these issues around voting. But, you know, just to step back, I mean, Garland has come out and been pretty, made some really strong statements about the need to protect voting rights. He's made some pretty bold pronouncements about reforming police, and he's restarted some of these investigations into local police departments that were shut down during the Trump administration. So it hasn't been, you know, disappointment across the board, I wouldn't say, for progressives here, but, you know, obviously, after coming out of the administration, the Trump administration, there's a lot of desire for accountability. And I think that he's taking a very measured approach, and his, you know, I think his guiding star is probably the legitimacy of the Justice Department and sort of, you know, going back to those norms that we, that were sort of in place, I think, post Watergate. And I think that that's his overall guiding philosophy. And that isn't to say that he's not going to prosecute anyone at all and just we're turning a new page, because just look at the approach that he's taken to Rudy Giuliani. That was a pretty extraordinary measure in terms of raiding the home of the former attorney for the president of the United States. That was a pretty significant move. And I think that if the evidence presents itself and there's a clear case going forward, that that's something that will be pursued. But what wouldn't be good for the country is if, you know, they got ahead of their skis and charged something that the evidence didn't fully support, because we know what the immediate reaction is going to be. You can see what the immediate reaction is going to be from those people who are charged, and it's going to be the immediate charge of this is all political. So what I think Merrick Garland wants to do is set up a system in which everything isn't seen strictly through a political lens. So I would expect as we go on that this isn't something that when there are cases that are going to be able to be brought, that they'll be brought. But I don't think that, you know, there's going to be as many prosecutions certainly as some people on the left would necessarily want.
He seems very consciously, I don't know that he thinks in these terms at all, because as you point out, given his background, he's not a rabid partisan. But it does seem that in so many ways, his Justice Department is sort of the Bill Barr kind of Justice Department, that he's very, very anxious to show the independence, the non-political nature of it, perhaps leaning over backwards too far to make that point.
I think that overall, I would say that, you know, Justice Department employees are probably pretty satisfied with the approach he's taken, because they don't want to be sort of political pawns. They don't want to just be actors that go every 4 years sort of swing back and forth and take completely contradictory positions in court. And that's, you know, that's that sort of grind between politics and the law right now, where we saw this during the Obama administration, where there were things that the administration defended, including, I believe, DOMA at the time, which they abhorred politically, but continued to defend in a limited capacity in court. And you can't really have, that's going to take away a lot of the credibility of the Justice Department before judges if they're just taking these wildly different political, or rather legal, positions in court as the political spectrum sort of swings. So I think that that's something that, you know, you need to keep it within the confines and not have these wild swings legally. You need to keep everything sort of within the confines and make consistent arguments, maybe drop arguments going forward if they don't line up with the political goals of the administration. But I think they are trying to draw that pretty hard line between, you know, the communications between the White House and the Justice Department. And sometimes that's causing, I think, some tension, because we just came off an administration that didn't care about those lines and didn't care about keeping that separation between DOJ and the White House. And that's a big switch to put in place all at once. And it's causing, I think, some tension within the administration.
It is tempting. And I find myself torn between, on the one hand, saying, okay, it's important that everybody be held accountable. No one is above the law, and there must be a reckoning for all this, on the one hand, versus recognizing that, okay, one of the worst things about the Trump administration and Bill Barr was the threat of politicization, the whole lock her up cycle. And you get into the lock her up cycle where, as you point out, you know, one administration begins going after the previous administration, and then every 4 years you have this sort of, you know, back and forth, lock him up, lock her up. It gets very ugly, and the downward spiral can be very, very, very rapid. So I do get there's real tension between those. I mean, there really is, and I can actually see both sides of it, because I mean, I share the frustration of people, you know, who look at this and go, how do powerful people break the law? How do they lie and then suffer no consequences? I mean, there's something deeply wrong, something deeply subversive of the Constitution if anyone is above the law. But on the other hand, do we want this constant back and forth of trials? And I don't know. I mean, I think we have a sense of where Merrick Garland comes down on that question.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that even just with Trump and January 6th, right? And who is most accountable for what happened on January 6th? And those are the toughest cases to make. The people who are up on that podium and saying, fight for Trump, and, you know, this is the end of America, who riled up that crowd to do what they ultimately did, I think, you know, hold a tremendous amount of moral culpability for what happened. The problem is that that's really difficult to do under our system in terms of legal culpability, because there's First Amendment concerns that are really prominent in those cases. And, you know, political speech is very highly protected. So when someone says fight is something that's used all of the time in political rhetoric. We can't be charging people criminally when they say you got to fight, right? It's just really complicated issues. And the people who were the most responsible have the most legal protections, really, rather than sort of the pawns, I suppose, who acted through on that and, you know, absorbed that logic and said, oh, this is the end of America. This is 1776 2.0. I've got to do something about it. And just, you know, and acted on and sort of followed through and acted on what they were hearing, which is that the election was stolen. And if you hear that the election was stolen, this is the end of America. There's going to be this communist takeover of the country. That, you know, you're going to act on that. You're not just going to have your little peaceful protest and sit back. And that's, I think, what the problem is going forward is finding accountability and holding those people accountable. Yeah.
Well, interesting you mentioned it, because that is coming up in a lot of the trials. The people go, okay, I was misled. I believed all of that. And I think this is a point that needs to be made over and over again, that if you in fact believe that the election has been stolen, if you believe there is this evil takeover of your country, then the response becomes at least understandable, if not defensible. And that is the argument. I'm basically saying, you know, I listened to this. I got my information from the president. I got the information from Fox News, and I acted on it in a way that seemed to be reasonable and rational to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that I know, or I at least think of knowing, that there's this constant thing with politicians where you're like, do they actually believe this, or are they just like appeasing a crowd, or are they actually this like not smart, unintelligent? And I think that like in a lot of cases, it's clear that they don't believe this, because if they actually believed it every day, they should be like sitting in on the well of the Senate, right? If you actually thought that there is this illegitimate president in place, you would resist that at every moment possible.
Yes.
Like, even if you did it completely peacefully, every single moment should just be, this is an illegitimate president. None of this is legitimate. You should be protesting every second you're on the floor. And that's not what they're doing, because a lot of these politicians know that's not what happened, right? I would not say that most people who voted against the election actually thought that, you know, the Dominion machines were stealing millions of votes and just, or some of these crazy conspiracy theories that are out there, but they have to appease that crowd that actually does believe these things. And so that's where this sort of grind, I think, sort of takes place. And they give themselves away a little bit by not being constantly resisting everything that the administration does.
Well, and that's one of the moments that we're going through here. Even people who are close to, for example, you know, former President Trump, according to this new book, can't figure out whether or not he believes this stuff. I mean, there's nothing new about politicians saying something they don't necessarily believe because they're throwing red meat to their base. I mean, that's been going on for a long time, but it does seem to be, you know, very much part of this particular moment that nobody knows whether anyone really believes this stuff that's having these cataclysmic consequences, right? I mean, the thing about the big lie is it is so big and it is so consequential. And so it is relevant. Are the people who are spreading it, do they actually believe this, or are they just saying it? Now, many of the people who act on it, and this is important, I think, to understand, the people who act on it do genuinely believe it. I mean, they believe it down to the cellular level, whether or not they really have any idea, like the guy that you wrote about who thought that they were attacking the White House, not the Capitol. I mean, it's like, what do you say about that person? I'm not defending that person. I'm just trying to explain, you know, the way the shit flows downhill sometimes.
Yeah. And I think the difficult thing is pulling people out of that belief, because, you know, if you were fooled by this, it's pretty embarrassing that you got fooled by this. And it's going to be pretty hard to admit that you were wrong and you got suckered, right? And I think that that's really what the issue is here, because it's very hard for people who know a lot about how elections work or know anything about, you know, the system to pull someone out of this based on all of the stuff they've been reading on Facebook for, you know, for months and months and years, and say that, you know, no, this doesn't make any sense. It's hard to do that in a way that doesn't make that person who was suckered by this information feel that you're not talking down to them. I think that that's a very difficult thing to do. And that's where we've seen now that people have been charged who have come clean on this. But I think that for people who didn't storm the Capitol, that's a more difficult thing to admit that, yeah, I believed this. I shouldn't have believed it. You know, I'm going to sort of take my lumps over it and learn a lesson from it going forward and not be as trusting as unreliable sources as I should, as I shouldn't be, because, you know, I absorbed a lot of information that wasn't true. So I think that that's really what the issue is here for, you know, a large portion of the Republican Party is pulling people back from that illusion. And, you know, just, we need a shared reality here. And I think both on the what happened in the 2020 election and what happened on January 6th, I think that's something we're going to struggle to get, because there are these completely opposing pictures of what happened on election day, and where some people think that Donald Trump is legitimately elected president of the United States and is going to be reinstalled next month. And what happened on January 6th, where some people seem to think that was a peaceful protest and everything was fine, when in reality, it was this brutal slugfest that happened over hours of time and took over the Capitol.
Well, that's why these court cases are so interesting, because you're right, of course, that we do live in a political world where we have dueling realities, alternative realities. But in the justice system, it's still fact-based. And you have many of these things that, you know, come up against the big lie, or these cases, they come up against a court of law where the truth actually matters. And so far, the judicial system has been kind of the one institution that I think has performed. Tell me whether you disagree. I think it performed extraordinarily well as a bulwark for our system. We may have Congress going down the rabbit holes, or other politicians or media outlets going down the rabbit holes. But when these things hit a court of law, even guys like Rudy Giuliani have to admit, yeah, I don't have any evidence of fraud. I can tweet about fraud. I can go on Facebook and talk about fraud. I can go on OAN or Newsmax or Fox News and talk about fraud. But when I'm standing in a courtroom in front of a federal judge, facts still matter. There is one reality, and I have to swear an oath to it. And that's good news, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you saw it even in that case yesterday, where the judge sentenced someone to a significant 8-month sentence, but it was much less than what the 18 months that prosecutors desired there. And it's very difficult to look at that case and look what happened and look what unfolded and say, okay, this was political. This was an individualized decision based on his conduct that day and based on the law. They looked at the evidence, they looked at the law, they looked at the credit he deserved for cooperating, they looked at the plea deal, they looked at his criminal history and decided an individualized sentence for him based on what happened, his background, the deterrent effect needed to go forward. So it's very difficult for someone to come in afterwards and say, oh man, they really threw the book at him. This is political. Look at the system going against this person, when there's that individualized look at things. So yeah, I think the judicial branch is an extraordinarily important component to this. But, you know, sadly overall, I think that even that branch has gone down in terms of public believability, in terms of people very much think that it's still this political beast. And I think that it certainly is by no means outside of politics. It is influenced by politics for sure, but there is that attachment to reality, and there's not that ability to just throw out crazy things. That doesn't fly in court. So that is something we have, at least a fact-grounded, I think you're very right, a fact-grounded branch of government that's going to be very important going forward, where there's not going to be that political fight like you're going to see on the January 6th commission, because no one says what about, you know, Minneapolis? Or if you did, the judge is like, that's not relevant. Let's bring it back here. Let's talk about what's happening, you know, in this case, rather than, you know, doing whataboutisms.
And you know, that's what Jim Jordan's going to be doing on that committee, a lot of whataboutism. Ryan Riley, thank you so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast today and talking about this. Ryan Riley is a senior justice reporter for the Huffington Post. You can read his work there, and you're working on a book, right, on the FBI and the way. Tell me about what your book is. I won't try to characterize it.
Yeah, it's about this real pivot point that I think we are seeing after January 6th. So it's both about this extraordinary manhunt and about what the FBI does from here and where they go from here. You know, I don't obviously 9/11 was a much more brutal, much more violent. I don't want to make that, I'm not trying to make that comparison directly, but I do think in terms of a pivot point that we are going to see something somewhat similar after January 6th. And, you know, there was obviously this big change at the FBI after September 11th, and I think we're going to see sort of the same trajectory, maybe on a smaller scale, at the FBI going forward after January 6th.
All right, looking forward to it. We'll talk to you when the book comes out, Ryan. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.